Chapter 5. The Pardon Committee of the City of New York, and have nothing to do but sit on the platform, solemn and imposing, along with Peter Cooper, Horace Greeley, etc., etc., and shed momentary fame at second hand on obscure lecturers, draw public attention to lectures which would otherwise clack eloquently to sounding emptiness, and subdue audiences into respectful hearing of all sorts of unpopular and outlandish dogmas and isms. That is what I desire for the cheer and gratification of my gray hairs. Let me but sit up there with those fine relics of the old red sandstone period, and give tone to an intellectual entertainment twice a week, and be so reported, and my happiness will be complete. Those men have been my envy for long, long time, and no memories of my life are so pleasant as my reminiscence of their long and honorable career in the tone-dashing parting service. I can recollect that first time I ever saw them on the platforms just as well as I can remember the events of yesterday. Horace Greeley sat on the right, Peter Cooper on the left, and Thomas Jefferson, Red Jacket, Benjamin Franklin, and John Hancock sat between them. This was on the 22d of December, 1799, on the occasion of the state funeral of George Washington in New York. It was a great day, but a great day, and a very, very sad one. I remember that Broadway was one mass of black crepe from Castle Garden nearly up to where the City Hall now stands. The next time I saw these gentlemen officiate was at a ball given for the purpose of procuring money and medicines for the sick and wounded soldiers and sailors. Horace Greeley occupied one side of the platform on which the musicians were exalted, and Peter Cooper the other. There were other tone imparters attendant upon the two chiefs, but I have forgotten their names now. Horace Greeley, gray-haired and beaming, was in sailor costume, white duck pants, blue shirt, open at the breast, large neckerchief, loose as an ox bow, and tied with a jaunty sailor knot, broad turnover collar with star in the corner, shiny black little tarpaulin hat roosting daintily far back on head, and flying two gallant long ribbons. Slippers on ample feet, round spectacles on benignant nose, and pitchfork in hand, completed Mr. Greeley, and made him, in my boyish admiration, every inch a sailor, and worthy to be the honored great-grandfather of the Neptune he was so ingeniously representing. I shall never forget him. Mr. Cooper was dressed as a general of militia, and was dismally and oppressively warlike. I neglected to remark, in the proper place, that the soldiers and sailors in whose aid the ball was given had just been sent in from Boston. This was during the War of 1812. At the Grand National Reception of Lafayette, in 1824, Horace Greeley sat on the right, and Peter Cooper to the left. The other tone imparters of the day are sleeping the sleep of the just now. I was in the audience when Horace Greeley, Peter Cooper, and other chief citizens imparted tone to the great meetings in favor of French liberty in 1848. Then I never saw them any more until here lately, but now that I am living tolerably near the city, I run down every time I see it announced that Horace Greeley, Peter Cooper, and several other distinguished citizens will occupy seats on the platform. And next morning, when I read in the first paragraph of the phonographic report that Horace Greeley, Peter Cooper, and several other distinguished citizens occupied seats on the platform, I say to myself, thank God, I was present. Thus I have been enabled to see these substantial old friends of mine sit on the platform, and give tone to lectures on anatomy, and lectures on agriculture, and lectures on stirpiculture, and lectures on astronomy, on chemistry, on miscegenation, on S-man descended from the kangaroo, on veterinary matters, on all kinds of religion, and several kinds of politics. And have seen them give tone and grandeur to the four-legged girl, the Siamese twins, the great Egyptian sword swallower, and the old original Jacobs. Whenever somebody is to lecture on a subject not of general interest, I know that my venerated remains of the old red sandstone period will be on the platform, Whenever a lecturer is to appear whom nobody has heard of before, nor will be likely to seek to see, I know that the real benevolence of my old friends will be taken advantage of, and that they will be on the platform and in the bills as an advertisement. And whenever any new and obnoxious deviltry in philosophy, morals, or politics is to be sprung upon the people, I know perfectly well that these intrepid old heroes will be on the platform to, in the interest of full and free discussion, and to crush down all narrower and less generous souls with the solid dead weight of their awful respectability. And let us all remember that, while these inveterate and imperishable presiders, if you please, appear on the platform every night in the year as regularly as the volunteered piano from Steinway's or Chickering's, and have bolstered up and given tone to a deal of questionable merit and obscure emptiness in their time, they have also diversified this inconsequential service by occasional powerful uplifting and upholding of great progressive ideas which smaller men feared to meddle with or countenance. Our precious lunatic, from the Buffalo Express, Saturday, May 14, 1870. New York, May 10. The Richardson McFarland jury had been out 1 hour and 50 minutes. A breathless silence brooded over court and auditory, a silence and a stillness so absolute, notwithstanding the vast multitude of human beings packed together there, that when someone far away among the throng under the northeast balcony cleared his throat with a smothered little cough, it startled everybody uncomfortably, so distinctly did it grate upon the pulseless air. At that imposing moment the bang of a door was heard, then the shuffle of approaching feet, and then a sort of surging and swaying disorder among the heads at the entrance from the jury room told them that the 12 were coming. Presently all was silent again, and the foreman of the jury rose and said, "Your Honor and gentlemen, we, the jury charged with the duty of determining whether the prisoner at the bar, Daniel McFarland, has been guilty of murder, in taking by surprise an unarmed man and shooting him to death, or whether the prisoner is afflicted with a sad, but irresponsible insanity which at times can be cheered only by violent entertainment with firearms, do find as follows, namely, that the prisoner, Daniel McFarland, is insane as above described. Because, 1. His great-grandfather's stepfather was tainted with insanity, and frequently killed people who were distasteful to him. Hence, insanity is hereditary in the family. 2. For 9 years the prisoner at the bar did not adequately support his family. Strong circumstantial evidence of insanity. 3. For 9 years he made of his home, as a general thing, a poor house. Sometimes, but very rarely, a cheery, happy habitation. Frequently the den of a beery, driveling, stupefied animal, but never, as far as ascertained, the abiding place of a gentleman. These be evidences of insanity. 4. He once took his young unmarried sister-in-law to the museum. While there his hereditary insanity came upon him to such a degree that he hiccuped and staggered, and afterward, on the way home, even made love to the young girl he was protecting. These are the acts of a person not in his right mind. 5. For a good while his sufferings were so great that he had to submit to the inconvenience of having his wife give public readings for the family support, and at times, when he handed these shameful earnings to the barkeeper, his haughty soul was so torn with anguish that he could hardly stand without leaning against something. At such times he has been known to shed tears into his sustenance till it diluted to utter inefficiency. Inattention of this nature is not the act of a democrat unafflicted in mind. 6. He never spared expense in making his wife comfortable during her occasional confinements. Her father is able to testify to this. There was always an element of unsoundness about the prisoner's generosities that is very suggestive at this time and before this court. 7. 2 years ago the prisoner came fearlessly up behind Richardson in the dark, and shot him in the leg. the prisoner's brave and protracted defiance of an adversity that for years had left him little to depend upon for support, but a wife who sometimes earned scarcely anything for weeks at a time, is evidence that he would have appeared in front of Richardson and shot him in the stomach if he had not been insane at the time of the shooting. 8. 14 months ago the prisoner told Archibald Smith that he was going to kill Richardson. This is insanity. 9. 12 months ago he told Marshal P. Jones that he was going to kill Richardson. Insanity. 10. 9 months ago he was lurking about Richardson's home in New Jersey and said he was going to kill Richardson. Insanity. 11. 7 months ago he showed a pistol to Seth Brown and said that that was for Richardson. He said Brown testified that at that time it seemed plain that something was the matter with McFarland, for he crossed the street diagonally 9 times in 50 yards, apparently without any settled reason for doing so, and finally fell in the gutter and went to sleep. He remarked at the time that McFarland acted strange, believed he was insane. Upon hearing Brown's evidence, John W. Galen, M.D., affirmed at once that McFarland was insane. 12. 5 months ago, McFarland showed his customary pistol, in his customary way, to his bedfellow, Charles A. Donna, and told him he was going to kill Richardson the first time an opportunity offered. Evidence of insanity. 13. 5 months and 2 weeks ago McFarland asked John Morgan the time of day, and turned and walked rapidly away without waiting for an answer. Almost indubitable evidence of insanity. And, 14. It is remarkable that exactly 1 week after this circumstance, the prisoner, Daniel McFarland, confronted Albert D. Richardson suddenly and without warning, and shot him dead. This is manifest insanity. Everything we know of the prisoner goes to show that, if he had been sane at the time, he would have shot his victim from behind. 15. There is an absolutely overwhelming mass of testimony to show that an hour before the shooting, McFarland was anxious and uneasy, and that 5 minutes after it he was excited. Thus the accumulating conjectures and evidences of insanity culminate in this sublime and unimpeachable proof of it. Therefore, Your Honor and gentlemen, we the jury pronounce the said Daniel McFarland innocent of murder, but calamitously insane. The scene that ensued almost defies description. Hats, handkerchiefs and bonnets were frantically waved above the mastheads in the courtroom, and 3 tremendous cheers and a tiger told where the sympathies of the court and people were. Then 100 pursed lips were advanced to kiss the liberated prisoner, and many a hand thrust out to give him a congratulatory shake, but presto! With a maniac's own quickness and a maniac's own fury, the lunatic assassin of Richardson fell upon his friends with teeth and nails, boots and office furniture, and the amazing rapidity with which he broke heads and limbs, and rent and sundered bodies, till nearly 100 citizens were reduced to mere quivering heaps of fleshy odds and ends and crimson rags, was like nothing in this world but the exultant frenzy of a plunging, tearing, roaring devil of a steam machine when it snatches a human being and spins him and whirls him till he shreds away to nothingness like a hour clock before the breath of a child. The destruction was awful. It is said that within the space of 8 minutes McFarland killed and crippled some 60 persons and tore down a large portion of the City Hall building, carrying away and casting into Broadway 6 or 7 marble columns 54 feet long and weighing nearly 2 tons each. But he was finally captured and sent in chains to the lunatic asylum for life. By late telegrams it appears that this is a mistake. Editor Express. But the really curious part of this whole matter is yet to be told. And that is, that McFarland's most intimate friends believe that the very next time that it ever occurred to him that the insanity plea was not a mere politic pretense was when the verdict came in. They think that the startling thought burst upon him then, that if 12 good and true men, able to comprehend all the baseness of perjury, proclaimed under oath that he was a lunatic, there was no gainsaying such evidence, and that he unquestionably was insane. Possibly that was really the way of it. It is dreadful to think that may be the most awful calamity that can befall a man, namely, loss of reason, was precipitated upon this poor prisoner's head by a jury that could have hanged him instead, and so done him a mercy and his country a service. Postscript later, May 11, I do not expect anybody to believe so astounding a thing, and yet it is the solemn truth, that instead of instantly sending the dangerous lunatic to the insane asylum, which I naturally supposed they would do, and so I prematurely said they had, the court has actually set him at liberty. Comment is unnecessary. M. T. The European Wars, from the Buffalo Express, July 25, 1870. First day of the European War. No battle yet. Hostilities imminent. Tremendous excitement. Austria arming. Berlin, Tuesday. No battle has been fought yet. But hostilities may burst forth any week. There is tremendous excitement here over news from the front that two companies of French soldiers are assembling there. It is rumored that Austria is arming what with, is not known. Second day of the European War, no battle yet. Fighting imminent. Awful excitement. Russia sides with Prussia. England neutral, Austria not arming. Berlin, Wednesday. No battle has been fought yet. However, all thoughtful men feel that the land may be drenched with blood before the summer is over. There is an awful excitement here over the rumor that two companies of Prussian troops have concentrated on the border. German confidence remains unshaken. There is news to the effect that Russia espouses the cause of Prussia and will bring 4,000,000 men to the field. England proclaims strict neutrality. The report that Austria is arming needs confirmation. Third day of the European War, no battle yet. Bloodshed imminent, enormous excitement, invasion of Prussia. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.